Okay, we're back for episode 106 of Powers and Principalities. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, this week we decided to discuss on the 25th anniversary of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, the O.J. Simpson murder case. This was 25 years ago. It's hard to believe. I remember it like it was, well, not yesterday, but maybe the day before yesterday. And, the O.J. Simpson murder case, vast coverage for obvious reasons. It dominated the news cycle for a better part of a year, more than a year, actually. And, of course, we all remember the so-called chase, the 35-mile-per-hour chase on the highway with the Ford Bronco, 93 Ford Bronco, with O.J. Simpson and his friend Al Cowlings. It was kind of like surreal when it was happening because O.J. Simpson was such a star, sort of beloved, former NFL star, ran for 2,000 yards in a year that only played 14 games for a mediocre football team. He was a great football player, and he became sort of a TV star, then movie star, some movies. So he was a celebrity, popped up on the Tonight Show and, Johnny Carson. It was open ceremonies, the 84 Olympics. But then he got this report that his wife and an acquaintance, a waiter at this bar, Mezzaluno, had been brutally murdered outside her home. And, of course, it turned out that O.J. Simpson was the primary suspect because he was eventually indicted, brought up on charges, and acquitted. So let's do – I got the summation from various sources in the internet. So let's, do a summation of the events. The O.J. Simpson murder case, officially People of the State of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, was a criminal trial held at the Los Angeles County Superior Court. Former NFL star football player, broadcaster, and actor O.J. Simpson was tried on two counts of murder for the June 12, 1994 slashing deaths of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman. On the morning of June 13, 1994... The couple was found stabbed to death outside Brown's condominium in the Brentwood neighborhood of Los Angeles. Simpson was a person of interest in their murders. He did not turn himself in, and on June 17th, he became an object of a low-speed pursuit in a white 1993 Ford Bronco SUV owned and driven by his friend Al Cowlings. The pursuit, arrest, and trial were among the most widely publicized events in American history. The trial, often characterized as the trial of the century because of its international publicity, spanned 11 months from the jury swearing in on November 9, 1994. Opening statements were made on January 24, 1995, and the verdict was announced on October 3, 1995, when Simpson was acquitted on two counts of murder. Following his acquittal, no additional arrests related to the murders have been made, and the crime remains unsolved to this day. Simpson was represented by a very high-profile defense team, also referred to as the Dream Team, which was initially led by Robert Shapiro, subsequently directed by Johnny Cochran. Other lawyers were Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, working for the defense. For the prosecution was Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden. She was the deputy district attorney, and so was Christopher Darden. They thought they had a strong case against Simpson, but Cochran was able to convince the jurors that there was a reasonable doubt concerning the validity of the state's DNA evidence, which was relatively a new form of evidence in the trials at the time. The reasonable doubt theory included evidence that the blood sample had allegedly been mishandled by the lab scientists and technicians, and there were questionable circumstances that surrounded other court exhibits. Cochran and the defense team also alleged other misconduct by the LAPD related to the systemic racism and the actions of Detective Mark Furman. Simpson's celebrity status, racial issues, and lengthy televised trial riveted national attention. The immediate reaction to the verdict created a division among racial lines. A poll of Los Angeles County residents showed that most African Americans felt that the justice system had been served by the not guilty verdict, while the majority of whites and Latinos expressed an opposite opinion on the matter. After the trial, the families of Brown and Goldman filed a civil lawsuit against Simpson. On February 4, 1997, the jury unanimously found Simpson responsible for both deaths. The families were awarded compensatory and punitive damages totaling $33.5 million, but have received only a small portion of that monetary figure. In 2000, Simpson left California for Florida, one of the few states where one's assets like homes and pensions cannot be seized to cover liabilities that were incurred in other states. So that's the summation of that phase, you know, of the trial, of the case itself. He did, was found responsible in a civil trial. Of course, a civil trial has a much lower bar or standard of evidence to you don't need a unanimous jury. And so it had a different outcome. So that's the summation of the case itself. Of course, I know if you in 2008 or 9, O.J. Simpson went to jail for kidnapping and robbery, I believe. And this was involved in a dispute over some sports memorabilia in Las Vegas. And he was convicted and sentenced to 33 years in prison. I think he's after 9 years, I think 2 years ago. Yeah, he was paroled and now I believe he resides in Florida. So that's where things stand now. So that's basically the O.J. Simpson case. We can get into why the prosecution's case fell apart, why there is such division in the public regarding the case, and there's so much misinformation and misunderstanding of the case. So, Joe, what do you have to say?
Well, first, I wanted to mention that the dream team of lawyers that O.J. assembled had a few other characters, and they're important to mention because you really end up with just an amazing cesspool. They had F. Lee Bailey.
Oh, yes.
Alan Dershowitz, for a time, showed up. You know, he's always around whenever there's a paycheck to be had. And, of course, our favorite Robert Kardashian, you know, the Family Value Award Father of the Year. he's donned the Kardashian children that are benefiting our culture to this very day. So when you look at that collection, man, you just wonder, you know, like, where are the mass shooters, you know, when you need them? You know, it's just, it just is incredible that you'd have such a collection of evil and, you know, under one roof defending OJ. And I just, you know, like, I know we're going to get into, you know, like the kind of a different perspective in the trial eventually. But I wanted to just mention, just from a personal note, that this really hit me hard in a lot of ways because I actually lived there. I lived on San Vicente, which was the cross street of the murder. And, you know, I think it was on, her house was on Bundy, which is a street I drove on all the time. Mezaluma, I mean, it was like a place where, you know, it was like kind of over my, you know, in the, it was a little too decadent for my taste. But
well, that may factor into what really happened, actually.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. But it was the fact that this was such a local thing to me. I mean, this was literally maybe a mile and a half from where I was living, and I actually, you know, knew people that actually had knew all of the characters, basically, you know, off and on. Like OJ was known by like half the people in Los Angeles because he was a gadabout. I didn't know him, but you know, people I didn't know knew him. And I knew someone who actually did know Nicole. She was a well-known socialite, to say the least. And I knew people who were were waiters and bartenders that knew Goldman. He was a waiter at Mezaluma, I believe. And so when this happened, it was it was pretty shocking. And particularly the manner of the death was very psychologically powerful. And, you know, I at the time I didn't have this thought, but now thinking back on, I wonder if it had, you know, it looks or it could have been all kind of orchestrated. You know, the spectacular way that she was basically decapitated. It was just, you know, that's the kind of thing you don't really need to release. Mm-hmm. And what's the point, you know? But it was everywhere, you know, that was basically everywhere. And so that was the, you know, my impression of the murder and the trial was that they were very, very personal. And I think that, you know, the ethnicities were still raw, because they were being ground down, you know, white was ethnicities were being forced into the suburbs, and then they were becoming the white middle class. Cultural Marxism was starting to identify white males, particularly, you know, for you know, the kind of a negative characterization. And so this murder was, you know, kind of hit the nerves because it was a black man killing a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
That was like a really kind of a visceral thing that, you know, if you know LA, like there are really kind of racial dividing areas, and Santa Monica, where this happened, is a white area. So all the people that knew Nicole that I knew were all white people, and everyone thought that OJ had done it. And they also thought that the black jury was racially motivated.
Yeah, that was the assumption that, you know.
That's 100% the assumption. In fact,
they all must be stupid, yeah.
Yeah.
Even though the three jury members, it was unanimous, of course.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know if it was, I don't think they saw them as stupid. I think they saw them as racially motivated.
Mm-hmm.
I read, you see, the major moment in the trial actually occurred before the trial began when Gil, what is his name?
Gil Garcetti.
Garcetti made the decision to move the trial to Los Angeles from Santa Monica.
Yes.
And when that happened in the Santa Monica papers, they actually quoted, you know, sort of prosecuting attorneys who said, well, this will mean at the very best there'll be a hung trial and there's no chance you can get a conviction of OJ. I mean, they just flat out said there would be a decision that would be basically because of race. And so that was the perception that white middle class Santa Monica had, you know, where the event occurred, of the trial, is that this was going to happen. People were afraid that, you know, OJ is going to get off. We know the black jury won't convict him. And then when it happened, that was how the community responded with real, I mean, you know, not with rioting, but with just a kind of racial rage. People were talking to one another about how terrible it is we have to share a jury system with these racially motivated black people. And there was also the thought that there was relief. And this was a sad thing. Remember, this wasn't too far from the Rodney King events.
Yes.
And so they were afraid that there would be a riot. And
people?
No, if OJ had been convicted.
Yeah, I always thought there was like, really? This is the assumption now that if an outcome of a decision, of a truck, you go out and riot? Whereas, no, that's only for those people over there.
So those were the, you know, that was kind of the on the ground white middle class guy's vision of the thing, is that it was a racial moment. It was part of the racial divide in America. When he was acquitted, the people I knew were just livid, and unless you were black, in which case, you know, you thought it was fine, you know.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of these people who were disappointed or shocked by the not guilty verdict, he was acquitted, more or less, you know, they didn't really follow the case in detail. They were following the media coverage of it. And the way the media was covering it, I guess you could be excused for thinking that you thought it was an open and shut case. The blood evidence was there. The timeline was there. So there was a very strong circumstantial case of O.J. Simpson's guilt. But for those who actually followed the trial, there were a lot of problems in the prosecution's case. The circumstantial case simply fell apart based on the tainted DNA evidence, the chain of custody, the fact that you know, the blood that was supposedly taken from the scene had this EDTA, anticoagulant preservative, that's put in blood that's abstracted from, you know, from suspects. O.J. Simpson had provided his blood voluntarily, even without a lawyer. And of course, the implication is that someone planted that blood, because the missing amount was pretty much what they had. They apparently got from the scene 1.5 milliliters, and there was 1.5 milliliters missing from the vial. And so the fact that the only explanation was the blood evidence that had been planted there. And this a lot of this evidence, this is the defense's case, or at least the defense was based upon this, and a lot of the defense was based on the research of a crime reporter author named Steven Singular. He's the author of Legacy of Deception, and through his research, he came across a lot of troubling. Lots of troubling evidence regarding not just the case.
Interrupt. Have you interviewed him?
No. I'm just I've done interviews about his work, about the case.
Sorry.
And he wrote a book called Legacy of Deception, I think in 1995 or 1996. But basically, yep. It was the book proposal. It was like a 22-page proposal that had been, I think, given to the defense, and then also the judge, Lance Ito, got it. Actually, it was leaked. And I think Chris Darden got it. The prosecutor got it, and Chris Darden got it. And he said the evidence was Brady material, meaning it was reasons to actually drop the case because of the evidence of misconduct. But basically, this trial, he found out that the presence of this blood preservative in the blood samples that were pulled, supposedly taken from the crime scene, and of course the implication is that the blood was indeed planted there. By either Van Patter or Mark Furman, the two detectives on the case. And he's an interesting one because Steven Singular had written a book called Talk to Death. It was a book about Alan Berg. He was a shock jock liberal DJ, a Jewish guy, I think in Colorado, who was assassinated in 1984 by a group called The Order, a neo-Nazi group. And in his research, he made some connections with this group to the LAPD and Mark Furman, so it opened up a whole can of worms, and this is why the defense started going down the route of systemic racism, or particularly regarding LAPD, and in particular Mark Furman. And Mark Furman did purge himself, and he had given some interviews to a screenwriter, saying some very troubling things about his attitude, calling himself God on the streets. He liked beating up black people because they didn't show the bruises.
And didn't he use the N-word?
He did use the N-word, denied using it. Then they had him on tape. And stuff.
Yeah, they had him on tape.
So he committed perjury, these things. And
in case someone doesn't know what that is, it's the word is nigger.
Yeah. It is a word. Yeah.
That's what
it's
that
a word.
Is.
It's not a nice word, but it is a word.
A slur against African Americans.
Yeah.
But I don't know how it became the N-word.
Now it's the N-word. I know. It's ridiculous.
If you say the N-word, it's better somehow than the word itself.
Even though you've put that word in someone's brain. Yeah.
So he was using
that word.
Yeah.
And so this became this motivation for things. Also evidence suggesting that he actually had known Nicole Brown Simpson prior to the murder. He'd been at the house. And a lot of the evidence was based on this fact that O.J. Simpson, they had some domestic disputes, and he was accused of beating his wife. It turns out that he was charged with battery. He never really beat. There was an altercation where he kind of manhandled her, and she fought back, and he pushed, and she fell down, and there was never anything really. It was blown out of proportion, and so in her eyes, domestic abuse. This is what happened. So obviously, must have killed her. In Ron Goldman, but yeah, the presence of blood the preserving the blood, to me, like I said, in my opinion, that's it. The case is blown out of the water at that point, because you're planting evidence and fraud vitiates everything, and that's a reason to drop the case. Other things with the bloody socks and the cap that didn't fit, the gloves didn't fit. Mark Furman found the glove at OJ's house and over at Nicole's house, and there were witnesses saying that she heard I think it was the next door neighbor's housekeeper heard two men arguing at 3:30 in the morning. Implication being it's Mark Furman and Van Patter arguing about this stuff. The chain of evidence, the chain of custody and the evidence was very poor. I mentioned the blood evidence, the fact that the blood was planted there with the preservative, but also the Bronco was taken into custody. The police took it in as evidence, and it was broken in twice Why under the control of the police? So that that's as a crime scene that's not worth anything anymore. And the story was that I think it was Furman spotted a dot of blood in O.J. Simpson's car at night, which isn't believable. And he also entered O.J. Simpson's house without a warrant, claiming he feared for his safety. So that you have all that going. So basically, there's a lot. I mean, again, a lot of people don't realize is that the case did fall apart on the blood evidence, and also the fact that the defense team had raised serious questions regarding the motivations and character of the chief witness, Mark Furman, which the prosecution did not call. The defense had to call him, so the prosecution didn't feel safe calling him for reasons that they found out, and he eventually resigned from the police force. And so this is all this evidence that Steven Singler had pulled up, had dug up and given to the defense. And the reality is the case just fell apart because the circumstantial case was flimsy at best. And that's why he was acquitted in under 4 hours. You know, and that's what most people aren't aware of in this case. Now the question goes, what really happened? And that's where you can get into some speculation, because all the evidence around the case suggests that it has something to do with drugs. The fact of the matter is the Goldmans, Simpson, Nicole, and OJ were in over their head with drugs. And that's the whole scene. This is where we get into the whole milieu or scene there. The seedy underworld of Hollywood or Brentwood, LA, whatever, where a lot of this sort of high living, wealthy, there's a lot of drugs floating around, and especially if there's celebrities and these things. This dates back to the 70s. Where O.J. Simpson was the target of a sting operation as early as the 1970s with drug dealing in Buffalo. So it's a long history going back here. It turns out that what the evidence suggests is O.J. Simpson and his friends and his friend Al Cowlings were they would get drugs for various celebrities and sports figures. And because of their celebrity status, they were kind of protected, But somehow or another, perhaps Nicole got it over her head, maybe trying to get into the business herself or raise money to get into her business. And her friend Faye Resnick, who she was on the phone with just before she died, at the time Faye Resnick was in rehab for cocaine addiction. There's also the fact that Ronald Goldman himself worked at the place Mezzaluna, which was kind of one of these suspected, not drug fronts, but money laundering operations, and also where a lot of drugs are traded. You said it's kind of the lifestyle there, the scene there was kind of life in the fast lane, so to speak. But Ronald Goldman was an aspiring actor, model, of course, waiter, like most actors are, right? but here's an interesting case about what really raises suspicion or speculation about the real nature of the case is, of course, Ronald Goldman has his throat cut. Two of his friends or acquaintances both died violent deaths a year before and a year after Ronald Goldman's death. I think it was Eddie Cantor or Billy Cantor was his name, who ran a nightclub that Ronald Goldman was promoting. He was found with his throat cut from ear to ear in 1993. And this guy, Michael Nigg, was shot to death a year after. So what are the chances of three young men in their 20s dying violent deaths? Not being related. And there are two other people who worked at Mezzaluna who disappeared during this thing. The Goldmans themselves, Ronald Goldman's stepmother was the ex-wife of a Marvin Glass, who was a lawyer working for the Colombian drug cartel, who was then convicted for that and had served time in prison. So there's that. And again, I alluded to the whole scene with O.J. Simpson, Al Cowlings, and these things were tied to another drug dealer named Joey Eppolito, who was kind of a drug kingpin who came from back east and went out to L.A. And they were connected to him through a stripper whose names were in her address book and these things. So if you're a detective and you're looking at the violent deaths and these things, it seems to me that was a much more plausible explanation for what really went down rather than O.J. Simpson being able to kill two people without getting much of a scratch, without getting a scratch on them, clean up and fly to Chicago, and then in such a quick time. There's another problem with the case was they never submitted Nicole Brown Simpson's phone records in the case. So, this is important to the timeline because when she was talking to her mother. Originally, they had her talking to her mother at 10:30, but that didn't work with the prosecution's timeline, so they switched it to 9:30. But it's funny, during the trial, they didn't submit the phone records. They submitted a cardboard facsimile of a phone record, but not the phone records itself. So that's never submitted in the evidence. There's all types of problems with the prosecution's case when you look at these things. And you look at all the evidence, it looks like it was some sort of drug hit, all things considered.
Well, I mean, the case was circumstantial, and you know, there evidently was fraud. I'm not 100% clear that it has been proven that the blood evidence was fraudulently inserted. In other words, that it was just a literally 100% concoction.
Well, here's the funny thing is the prosecution got that and they wanted the FBI lab to clear the blood sample. The FBI lab couldn't do it, and they didn't call the FBI back for as a witness because the FBI lab couldn't say that it wasn't. It had the EDTA stuff in.
They couldn't verify that it hadn't been tainted. This was when, remember, DNA evidence was brand new. It was quite fancy stuff back in 94. And I think that the chain of custody wasn't necessarily perfect. And so I don't know how unusual it was that the OJ blood sample got screwed up in that era. I think that was actually difficult for, you know, for d police departments to really know how to do chain of custody with blood samples at that time. So it's not surprising, but at the same time, you can't then turn around and say, well, accept the evidence, even though it's tainted, or even though we, you know, in that at that point, the evidence is just, you know, it's just no longer
And you know, another thing I forgot to mention is Ronald Goldman himself, the other victim of this case. He was a CI, a confidential informant for the LAPD. And his file, his criminal file, is still under seal. Well,
That is interesting. I
when you
didn't
have a
know.
confidence, maybe someone didn't maintain his confidentiality, and maybe Nicole Brown Simpson was collateral damage, and the primary target was Ronald Goldman. Considering the fact that two of his acquaintances would die, you know, one would be shot the year after, and one was died a similar death the year before. If you're a detective, if you're Columbo, you're gonna say just one more thing, right? You're gonna wait.
Well, you know, one thing you mentioned that it was possible that Nicole was trying to get into the drug business, and this was maybe a motivation for her death. I've never seen any actual evidence of that. Have you? I mean, is there? I know the assertion is kind of swirling around, but I've never actually seen any evidence of, like, you know, like phone conversations between Nicole and, you know, Bugsy Siegel or something like that.
Well, she was good friends with this Faye Resnick character,
It was a Resnick, and
who's a,
Resnick was, like, you know, a bad actor.
but yeah, and there was not so much the drugs. He was using, I think the allegation is their drugs are a way to raise capital to open a restaurant. You know,
Yeah, well,
and the way it works is open a restaurant, you get the funds by allowing your restaurant to be used as a laundering operation.
I'll tell you one thing.
So.
At this point in Brentwood, Santa Monica history, cocaine was just a way of life.
Yes.
It was just everywhere. It's just incredible to the extent that drugs had permeated what had been a, you know, 20 years earlier, just a real middle class area.
What's interesting is that you remember during the trial, it was sort of brought up a little, then dropped, because I guess the defense didn't want to make an affirmative defense. That way, you have to prove something. That would have opened up a whole can of worms with O.J. Simpson. What I alluded to earlier about O.J. Simpson being involved in this stuff years before, there was a series of deaths like down in Florida, who people were tied to O.J. Simpson and dying, going back to his Buffalo days. They were murdered all around the same time. So it seemed like there was a kind of a purge going on, which was completely ignored by the police and the media. So there's a whole, I think this is like the hidden grammar to this case. This is a whole nother story.
So
I know
what?
it's speculative, but it explains a lot more than this than O.J.
Yeah, it
Simpson
has
going.
explanatory power. I admit. Now, just but I'm because I actually am I'm not that familiar with this. You know, I don't know the guy Singletary is his name,
Stephen
who
Singular.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Stephen Singular.
Singular. He's a singular individual. Well, I'm not familiar with his information. You know, and so it's interesting, actually, that you know, there is evidently, you know, like such a strong rebuttal to the circumstantial case. So let's just assume that OJ didn't do it. Can you tell us why? Well, I know you can just speculate in terms of what the murder was about, but what was the purpose of the media circus, or was that just, you know, sort of an axiomatic event because of the celebrity status of the person they were accusing?
Well, I've kind of thought it because I mean, you've heard the other theory that it was O.J. Simpson's son that did it. That's seems to be less because he has had anger issues and there's some dispute over he's supposed to be at work that night, but then his time card was apparently played with. That's a whole another angle on that. But I think the drug angle is a more solid case. I mean, what would have how it would have gone down is that I think what's interesting when you look at like someone like Ronald Goldman being a confidential informant and being involved in this scene, someone, this guy Joey Eppolito, had been tried and convicted, and someone had talked to get his conviction. Well, could that someone have been, I don't know, Ronald Goldman, the confidential informant? I'm just speculating.
Yeah.
And he ends up dead, so that's just when once you get involved, once you get drug, and once you get involved the drug scene in LA, you open up a whole can of worms. Because, I mean, if you look at like what was exposed, with, the Dark Alliance series, with the Iran-Contra and the cocaine, the crack addiction, its connections to the CIA and the LAPD and the corruption, and that does involve corruption in the LAPD because they're involved in this too. You have the Rampart scandal. Well, that broke a few years later, where you had it was exposed that police were doing hit work for organized crimes. They were planting evidence and these things. That the very thing that O.J. Simpson's defense team said occurred was exposed in the Ramparts case. So it wasn't just a crazy, conspiracy theory. And once you get into the whole sort of milieu in Hollywood and L.A. And you get into something like drugs, if someone were to, take the case of Nicole Brown Simpson's murder and Ronald Goldman's murder and generally, give it a thorough, good faith investigation, you're gonna be stepping on a lot of feet and opening up a whole can of worms, many cans of worms that people might not want to be opened, to be covered up. And so why not just stage a sham trial and try to railroad this guy? He's got $20 million in the bank, he can probably defend himself, and he did. And so, who cares? That way, sort of the town's protected. It's the corporate business. It's very similar to something that occurred, with the Charles Manson case, where the real story is probably a lot more seedy, not as fantastic, but it involved sex cults and apparently pedophilia and pornography being filmed there. And drugs. And so when the murders occurred, Vincent Bugliosi kind of cooked up this theory of Charles Manson running a cult and having this weird eschatology of a race war, imminent race war that he was going to spark with these murders. Although the only people who were murdered were white people. But then, the idea was they're going to blame it on black people or something. But they never really did, right? And his whole eschatology about this race, this coming war, apparently was pulled from this guy Krishna Venta, this 1940s cult leader, and that's the story that Vincent Brigliosi told for the trial. But it was, from what I read, it's like completely made up. It's like basically it was covered up to cover up the fact that the trial was taken in this direction because to cover up certain seedy realities of L.A. Hollywood movie stars and these things, and why not just cover it up and create a sensational story? At the same time, you do have sort of this sort of public, besmirchment of sort of the hippie movement, the youth culture, the sort of
Yeah, I would
closing
say
out the '60s. So there's a cultural impact of this
it's
event.
definitely a besmirchment
Yeah,
of it.
yeah.
Yeah, there's no doubt, no more peace and love after
Yeah,
Charlie.
because I think a month later it was Altamont, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were heading in a bad direction. How strange, after it started out so promising with the acid tests and Allen Ginsberg, Ken Kesey. I mean, the whole thing was just tip to stern Masonic cesspool. But I am fascinated by this idea that that the OJ trial was just something, like an operation that if it was that. If you're correct, then that means that that it was wired and orchestrated by the highest levels, to use an expression, because they would have, if they were Like later with the Ramparts thing, you can see how high up the drug business goes, right? It goes right to the top. Who knows where the top
Yeah,
is?
look what
But
I mean, look what Gary Webb exposed.
it just it, well,
Yeah.
that's my point, is that this could have been like a stream which ended up in the river that Gary Webb was like describing. And so that may have been why they decided to like just focus so much on Simpson, because he was such, he's a perfect patsy for in some ways,
Yeah.
because his celebrity is so distracting, because we're so mesmerized by celebrity that that when you start speculating about it, it does, you get a lot of explanatory power out of the theory. And also the one thing that I was, because I did think Simpson was guilty, and I still think he may have been. I honestly don't know, but I know that the circumstantial case didn't have as much strength as a lot of people thought. And I never quite understood why the throat cutting. I mean, that would have indicated that the person had been like, it's hard to do that. If someone is resisting, even if you're much stronger, if they're trying to resist, they get their hands up,
How do you get two people out of any noise?
Yeah, that was, and they are, that is the technique of killing, of revenge killing in Masonic, rituals, basically.
Oh,
So,
one other thing is the original coroner
yeah.
had identified two different knives.
Was it Noguchi?
No, it was a golden, something golden, I think, and he, I think, and Noguchi, I think, was then brought in, if I got that right. But two different knives would indicate. The thing is, there were wounds on Goldman's body that suggested he was like, sort of being tortured. The
Yeah,
skin was
and
poked.
the idea that, see, I didn't know that he was a CI and that
Yeah.
he was a confidential informer. I mean, that really puts a whole new cast.
Yeah.
So suddenly, yeah, this doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's sad because it's one of the bedrock positions of real things as opposed to Masonic illusions. I always thought, well, at least we had the sinking of the Titanic and the OJ trial. Now I don't even have the OJ trial. I mean, it's just
Well, it's funny, it's reported that she was virtually decapitated, and people think, well, why? I mean, even if it's not something, apparently she was, knocked out, then Goldman was taken care of, then the assailant went back to her, and it doesn't sound, and then, you have all this going on. He's able to fly out to Chicago without get rid of the evidence, and never found the weapon, by the way. And clean up, go out there, and there's claim that the blood was there. So where is the wound that would have created the blood? And there, the prosecution could never find a witness that saw his hands cut
And the
on
other
the
thing
flight out.
I was surprised about is that if you know where Simpson's house is and where Nicole's is, it's a pretty long drive. I'm going to say it's 4 miles, but it's past very fancy houses. You got to go through Brentwood and up, what's the name of the street, but you have to, it's a very fancy neighborhood, and then across Sunset and up to where OJ's house are. But you pass dozens of homes. Dozens. Oh man, maybe a couple hundred. And these are homes that have security cameras. And you would have thought there would have been a security camera of Simpson's car driving down the street, because I mean, there were, even in that early era, that these were the homes that had security cameras. And I was kind of, so at the time, I remember being surprised that there weren't.
Yeah, the day of the murder, he was with her and with, I think, his in-laws or ex-in-laws. They were divorced at the time, but they, from all accounts, he would come frequently, go over to the house, play board games with the kids, and it was amicable. And even with the in-laws, and it doesn't jive with this. The very day he was with them earlier that afternoon, apparently, by all accounts, in good spirits and in good relation, that night, late that night, he'd come back and do this. They never really established a motive. It's the fact that it did. Isn't you jealous? I mean, yeah, I suppose, but that nor did they ever establish a relationship between her and, well, with who? Jealous with. He basically was portrayed as a mad, jealous husband, which doesn't based on the behavior, on videotape and photographs, it doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, the mad jealous husband motivation was never established very clearly.
You're just thrown out there. And then they used the fact that you had this, domestic disputes, saying, "Oh, well, he beat her." Well, that was an overstatement of what occurred. But you say that doesn't necessarily prove, even when husbands that do abuse wives, the vast majority don't kill them. that's not proof. So it's one of these things where it just doesn't really add up. And just the whole violent nature of the death, you have to agree that he just went insane and did this, and they never really established a motive other than jealousy, which is, to me, is very flimsy.
Yeah, well, in like a kind of possessiveness.
Yeah.
But they had been separated for some time, and
Yeah.
it wasn't like OJ was having a hard time getting dates, I mean,
Yes. No.
so I think that, yeah, I mean, it was the case. It's not to say he didn't do it. I mean, he, one thing one angle that has never, or I haven't heard explored. Simpson was knocked out like dozens of times on the football field, like Junior Seau. And, frankly, he could have just had a neurologic episode because of all the, the concussions, as far as I know. I mean, he, all of, if Simpson had actually been, he confessed and he had done it, then this just would have been another one of the, violent acts of sometimes suicides, but often, by acting out of ex-NFL players.
Yeah, but what's odd thing is, in all his career, his playing days, and maybe it was covered up, but there aren't any accusers of, violent sexual misconduct or anything like that. This is
Yeah.
like this is why everyone's so shocked about it. This was
Yeah,
the.
I mean, as far it certainly was. I mean, it certainly was a one-off.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he wasn't didn't have a habit of decapitating people. I mean, this wasn't ever brought
But
up.
again, so this is the case, and after all, he was acquitted. So why are people so find it so hard to believe in his innocence? it's one of these. This is the function maybe we want to focus on is this is the media. This is the fake reality created by the media, and people get locked into this faux reality that the media creates for them.
I always wondered about that. I mean, like, because, first of all, this thing was televised and it didn't have to. It wasn't like it was a normal thing. I guess it was legally always possible up till, in fact, up to the track after the fact, then they changed the laws. But you could permit it or you could turn it down. It was at the discretion of the
You
judge,
remember Jay
I
Leno
think.
had the dancing Itos?
I was going to bring that up, actually. That
It was just.
if there was anything that was positive and transcendence about this whole sad, tragic episode, it created the dancing Itos. I don't know. Have you ever seen the dancing
Oh,
Itos?
yeah, I remember when it was his shtick for a
Yeah,
few
with Jay
years.
Leno. I mean, but see, so this was. The thing was, it was, I don't know, it was like a horror movie, but then it was also a false reality. Then you had the dancing Itos. The comedians were just going berserk over this thing.
And people's vision of reality is often solidified by comedy.
Yeah. And so, God, what a sad, horrible experience for American culture. And, this was right at the height of the sort of the integration movement, and you can see that this was, it just created more desire by whites to flee the cities, and probably more needs by for blacks to like kind of circle the wagon. They felt this was the unfair kind of thing, like the Rodney King trial, and been like sort of. So it's just that, in a general sense, our understanding of reality is pixelated and it's manipulated so that we are, basically always in a state of confusion, and we are steered away from like clear-minded decisions. We protect ourselves. I mean, I'm not sure what would should have been the clear-minded, conclusion to people and analytically from the OJ thing, but what actually happened was just, the country became more divided, more just a nastier, meaner place to be, which I think is obviously something that the oligarchs would approve of.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is a lot of people's vision of the trial wasn't based on what they think actually might have happened. It was, you know, the issue of whether or not a fellow black man is going to be convicted, or is another black man going to get away with murder, killing a white girl, as opposed to the individual case itself, which, the fact of the matter is, even if those are legitimate issues, the trial itself should be based on the evidence and fact-finding, and then doing justice based on the evidence. And the fact of the matter is, the prosecution's case just simply fell apart because of the problems with the evidence. And the fact that they were able to raise reasonable doubt with the handling of the evidence and the motivations of the police, an acquittal seemed to be in order in these things. It just shows you that the media, and good example is just the fact that this question was even raised, that I didn't even know about it until 20 years later. It shows you what a poor job the media is doing.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll tell you, the one character that I actually did, was very curious about and suspicious, not so much at the time, but as the years went by and I saw him more and more on TV, is this Mark Furman.
Mm-hmm.
He gave an interview which was, like brought out in the trial. And this was very explosive. In fact, I think that this, if Simpson had been convicted, the Furman tape, which was prevented, which wasn't given in chamber, which actually was released to the public. Another interesting, decision by the judicial department. I mean, it would have led to a riot for sure, because Furman, using the N-word over and over again, and also the idea that he was God on the streets. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seemed too. It's as if, you had some cultural Marxist trying to create a perfect piece of verbiage to incite, the black community to riot. I mean, if you ever listen to the interview, it doesn't seem real. The answers are just artificial. I mean, I knew police people, and I didn't know anyone who would talk like that, public or private.
Yeah,
it was really, really weird. And then after the fact, he became kind of a minor talking head. You see him on TV shows.
Yeah, Fox News. They bring him on to talk about race issues.
and he
did the Martha Moxley case, right?
Is his credential, other than this bizarre racial diatribe, that he gave, which amazingly was recorded and then amazingly was found and brought into evidence and then was for some reason released to the public at the same time. Like, this is really going to help create a calm judicial mood in the population.
This might be the function, and Stephen Singler doesn't get into this because he looks at it from a typical sort of a right left, there's racist and there's like a neo-Nazi racist organization within the police departments, infesting the police departments, as if these are independent groups that are taking over the police department. I look at these groups as assets at the meta level, sort of like maintaining a strategy of tension. And these groups, whether it's the Order, Aryan Nation, these criminal gangs, or even like these are proxies for often police departments, FBI, intelligence agencies. If you're a counter-narcotics officer, if you're an FBI agent, you're going to sort of nurture and maintain these groups, not under the pretext of gathering information and intelligence, but also to make sure that every now and then they carry out a bank robbery, carry out a crime to sort of build your career, build your case. That's what the case of Waddy Bulger shows up in the FBI up in Boston.
Yeah.
Where they let him get away literally with murder for years so they could build a case on him, build other cases and make their career on it, let innocent people go to jail and people be murdered. At the same time, they're sort of they're aiding and abetting criminal activity in the process of building their career. And the same thing, how these groups will be kept at an arm's length and sort of be allowed to function. Let them deal drugs for a little while, raise funds and raise hell so they can justify the budget of the FBI. And at the same time, when the time comes, you can shut them down or arrest them and have a show trial, or and reap the rewards, budgetary and also the PR and you go down. This almost, this is, I mean, this goes off on another case, but this, I like I said earlier, this sort of, there's, when you look at this, this is speculation, but if you look at the OKC bombing, the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, the Ethel P. Murrah building, the book that I hardly recommend for that case is Aberration in the Heartland by Wendy Painting. Aberration Heartland, The Secret Lives of Timothy McVeigh. And, you know, there's a lot of problems with that scenario, that the official narrative. The idea of a, you know, an ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb doing that damage.
For oh, yeah. I mean, that just seemed ridiculous. Yeah.
But Timothy McVeigh seemed to be like an asset or some sort of agent and leading many lives. And if you read that book, that she does a great book. In that book, she sort of constructs Timothy McVeigh's life, talks about, not writes about it, his life and sort of the environment that he grew up in. And he grew up, I think, in Buffalo, then traveled to the Midwest eventually, then went into the Army, served in the Gulf War. But she takes on some of these sort of wild theories about Timothy McVeigh, you know, having an implant in his rear end and these things. And you're reading it, and it's almost like she's kind of dismissing it. Then she provides the evidence and says, well, there might be some validity to these things. But the point is that Elohim City, the place that he lived in for a while, was riddled with federal agents. And they had German intelligence agents. You know, Andre Strassmeyer was involved in this stuff. And it seemed to be some sort of sting operation that had been taken over or gone bad involving the FBI. And that also goes back to the World Trade Center bombing, another group that was treated like an asset that the FBI was fully aware of as a sting operation gone bad. That's where they were able to crack the case. They said the FBI are the ones that, you know, provided the bomb, and people don't really realize that, but that's actually the official story. So these groups are allowed to kind of operate for a while and maybe create mayhem for the purposes of strategy of tension and just to sort of create the chaos that, you know, that these agencies thrive in.
Yeah, and it's interesting to look at events like the OJ murder case as from the alchemical perspective.
Yeah,
is how is this affecting culture? You know, and when I was thinking about the OJ case earlier, you know, I just thought, God, it seemed like everyone in this, it seemingly is a victim, you know, of like cultural debasement. Simpson. You know, actually, you have to go back, but Simpson was sort of presented like Sidney Poitier as a kind of a white, you know, prospective black man.
Yes.
Because at this time, you had the creation of what I would call the spade or the street N-word. Mm-hmm. And this was, that project had, you know, it didn't just start with the Great Society programs, but had been going on earlier, obviously. And, you know, in hindsight, you know, my life makes some sense, actually, if I just pay attention. Like, I was in Watts in 59 and 60 before the riots. And, you know, there wasn't any of the N-word or what I would call the spade consciousness on the streets. The people were trying to be basically to raise themselves up economically, and so they were more interested in middle class appearance.
Yeah, they wore neckties.
Yeah, and even middle class vernacular. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a young kid, but I could sense that they were trying to basically and were proud of the kind of very kind of educated American English that they would speak, right? This was what was hip. And you could see with an ethos like that where this would have gone in 30, 40 years. But at the same time, there was also, you know, obviously other forces were organizing African-American culture to debase it, to create the spade, to create the, the debased culture they were going to try to dump integrated American baby boomers into later on. And so then you had the Watts riots, which, you know, again, it's just one of these mysterious things. And from that point on, the culture in Watts never really recovered, and it just succumbed to the to this creation of the spade, the hip kind of hip being would be like a pimp drug dealer. You know, this wasn't hip in 1959 in Watts. That wasn't the ethos. And so Simpson was kind of, the white people liked him. You know, he was like the Hertz rent-a-car guy. Through airports, but he was a crossover because he was pretty well spoken, and and so he was sort of given to American culture as, well, look, the blacks aren't really adopting the pimp attitude, the violence, here's O.J. Simpson. Bill Crosby was the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, when Crosby had the when he was the sexual abuse charges came out, there was, Crosby had been kind of one of the last sort of proponents of moral order, as a thing that could be beneficial, higher level moral order for the African-American community. And so when he was arrested, this black comedy said, Bill just got his nigger wake-up call. That was the, this comic response to Cosby's accusations. This comedian made that, crack. And so when O.J. was arrested, it had that kind of effect. In other words, the consciousness was teetering. Sidney Poitier, there was a lot of, images coming into white consciousness that kind of indicated that African-Americans were going to transition into just dark-skinned, American culture people. I think Simpson's trial was certainly, it was already well established by the mid 90s, but this was one of the last straws. They just thought, well, there's just so much violence in this culture. It's so dangerous. We've got to stay out further and further in the suburbs,
Mm-hmm.
And so Simpson, then, he's interesting, and if you look at his life, you can see that. I mean, he actually was, for a period of time, living in the projects. And his father, of all things, was a drag queen. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah,
but
I didn't know that. Wow.
His dad, was a well-known transvestite in San Francisco. And so Simpson, and then they put him on a football field and give him 15 concussions. So, I mean, he was pretty much, had difficult background, difficult circumstances, Of course, he was also a multimillionaire,
Yeah.
Yeah. But he had these issues in his life. And so you can see him as kind of someone who has been victimized. And then, of course, Nicole, I mean, why would she even be dating, a black man? What had led up to that? What was in her background that, a healthy ethnicity basically is centrifugal, right? That's almost self-definitional, right? You can't be a healthy ethnicity if you're not trying to basically recreate yourself. And so this crossover, where she's having, black, mixed race kids. I mean, obviously it's a very hip, popular thing, in current cultural Marxist culture, but in the world she grew up in, it wasn't the case. And so what had happened in her life that had, led her to this situation? I don't know. Oh, man.
Well, I think she was a waitress, and she was like 18 or something when they met. O.J. Simpson was 30. So,
well, there it is. I mean, and of course, he's being given all this, accolade, because one of the things that athletics, I think, was used as one of the things to, it creates this kind of confusion in the ethnicities, right? We have black heroes, and so then it just becomes harder for the white ethnicity, the European ethnicity, which is not even an ethnicity but a collection of ethnicities, to have centrifugal energy. Because now your sports heroes are O.J. and Michael Jordan and things like this.
Running and throwing a ball.
This is all part of the, slaughter of the cities theory that, E. Michael Jones brings out, where you can see that they're just atomizing out of existence, the European culture. It just disappears. And so Nicole was part of this. She was, you never know the individual circumstances. I never met her. I don't know what was going on. But, you know, in the broad strokes, you can see that these kinds of events, in many ways, and, you know, it's not an exaggeration to say that they can be seen as part of the deliberate cultural debasement. You know, the fact that they were together in the first place, you know, had children is, I'm sure you can trace some of this back to the programs that were set in motion in the late 50s and early 60s by the oligarchs.
Yeah, and one thing is using things like sports and entertainment to promote the degradation of culture. And,
yeah,
you know, the figures we admire, we're told to admire and want to emulate are just, you know, athletes and pop stars. And...
Yeah, which are, I mean, exactly. They're the ones that get all the media attention, and these are the very worst two kinds of cultural personalities.
Yeah, because living such a debased, degraded lifestyle, whether it's, degenerate behavior, drugs, and these things, that's what kind of... What I was alluding to earlier is that if you really investigate these things, you realize that, you know, these figures that we watch every day on television, whether they're acting or singing or throwing a ball, kicking a ball, running, is often they're up to their hips in drugs and all types of degenerate behavior because they're lavish with a lot of money, and then we're told to admire that, and that sort of creates the consumer culture. And we're drawn to relate to these figures because we're denied any ethnicity, and this is all part of sort of the melting pot of America, where you lose your ethnic identity, and all you have is Steeler Nation or the New England Patriots or Harley Davidson.
Right. But if you want to see like a European culture in action, you can watch shows like, Dual Survivor or Mountain Man, Naked and Afraid. They present Europeans typically in a post-electric environment. Mm-hmm. They have all of these shows now. God, there are so many of them. You know, they're all just in general neurolinguistic programming. Even like they have this thing called it's like American Picker. It's like they go back and they find old things and then they sell them. All of this is neurolinguistic programming. It's obviously deliberate. None of these shows would exist if the culture was, representing itself. These are all just the archaic revival.
Well, did you see what the latest thing with the FBI tapes of Martin Luther King Jr.?
No, what?
About apparently the FBI has tapes of him witnessing and encouraging rape of a young woman.
Well, I mean, he was an artificial character. I mean, he was, presented as a saint and a religious person, but he couldn't have gone along with the lifetime acting aspect of what was, what he was, if he wasn't really, a very deeply evil individual, right?
Yeah.
And it's just part and parcel. If he's lying with his, I may not make it to the mountaintop speech he gives at the Masonic Hall foreseeing his death 24 hours later. If that's a lie, which I, will assert as a fact it is, then you're looking at, a deeply evil, controlled individual who has taken oaths to a dark secret society. And so when you hear something like this, it's like, well, yeah, it makes perfect sense.
It's one of these things where one thing that people have kind of known about is sort of the civil rights movement and a lot of these black pastors, the pervasive sexual corruption of them. And that sort of permeates throughout the black community and leads to a lot of the problems that in the black community with sort of the sexual irresponsibility and family disillusion or breakup, whenever forming to begin with. And we wink and nod at this and sort of accept it. But another thing is, so we find out these heroes have clay feet, and not only clay feet, it's just that they're just not the figures that were, again, this goes back to what I was saying, the image that we're given is completely false.
Yeah.
You know,
Bill Crosby, O.J. Simpson, yeah. Martin Luther King, you have the face that's given to the public, but then we have to always remember that the pixelated reality is manipulated reality.
Yeah, and they're.
The idea that there's something real and evil in back of it, well, that's something we should just have as an assumption when we look at the pixelated reality, because that assumption helps us resist the propaganda.
So, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yes, sir. I think we did. Well, we have to have we have a hung jury. We can't convict OJ, I'm afraid, at this point. Anyway, Jeff, thank you so much for the
Okay.
discussion. I'll talk to you next week.
Enjoy your weekend. Bye bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.